A Transmutation of Muddles by Horace Brown Fife, Part 1 of 2. The rugged little stellar scout ship flared down to the surface of Kappa Orionis 7, about a mile from the aboriginal village. The pilot, Lieutenant Eric Haruhiku, scorched an open field, but pointed out to Lewis Main that he had been careful to disturb neither woodland nor shoreline. "The Kappas are touchy about those, Judge," he explained. "They fish a lot, as you'd guess from all these shallow seas, and they pick fruit in the forest, but they don't farm much." "No use provoking trouble," Main approved. "It's a long way from Rigel." "It's a longer way from Sol," said the pilot. "Don't I know, boy. If I weren't, I'd be just another retired space captain quietly struggling with my ranch on Rigel 9. As it is, to get the grant, I had to remain on call as an arbitrator." "Somebody has to settle these things," said Haruhiku. "There's not much law way out here except what the Space Force can apply." "Well, if you'll excuse me, sir, I'll have them get out the helicopter and take us over to the village." "Let me see that message again before you go," Main requested. The pilot extracted a sheet from his clipboard and handed it to Main as he left. Main studied the text with little pleasure. "Terran Space Force headquarters on Rigel 9 wished to inform him that the long-awaited envoy from Terra to Kappa Orionis 7 not only had arrived but had departed 2 days behind Main. It was hoped," the communication continued, "that nothing would interfere with the desired objectives of coming to some friendly agreement with the Kappans that would permit Terran use of the planet as a base for spaceships. The envoy, of course, was prepared to offer trade inducements and various other forms of help to the semi-civilized natives. Main was requested to lay whatever groundwork he could." "In my spare time, no doubt," he reflected, "I'm to settle this silly business any way at all, as long as the natives get their way. But has anyone told the government about insurance companies? If it costs money or a lawsuit, will they back me up?" He felt himself to be in a ridiculous dilemma. The Kappans were reported to have seized a Terran spaceship as it landed to trade. Naturally, the captain had squawked for help. He claimed he had crashed. His insurance company thought otherwise. The Kappan seemed to have some entirely different idea in mind. Main had been summoned into action to render a decision after the rough-and-ready system of these settlements on the surface of Terra's sphere of explored space. Regretfully, he made his way to the cubbyhole allowed him on the cramped scout, where he changed to a more formal tunic of a bright blue he hoped would look impressive to native eyes. By the time he was ready, the helicopter was waiting. He and Haruhiku entered, and the crewmen at the controls took off for the scene of the dispute. Arriving over the village, they hovered a few minutes while Haruhiku studied the lay of the land. The lieutenant had been to this world before, long enough to pick up some of the language and customs, so Main was content to follow his advice about landing a little way off from a spaceship that towered outside the village. They came down about 100 yards away between a rutted sort of road and a long hut covered by a curved thatched roof. "They're expecting us," said Haruhiku, gesturing at the group before the hut. It consisted of half a dozen humans and several of the Kappan natives. The latter naturally caught Main's eyes first. The most imposing individual among them stood about 5 feet tall. The planet being of about the same mass as Terra, the Kappan probably weighed over 250 pounds. He was a rugged biped, with something Saurian in his ancestry, for his skin was scaled, and bony plates grew into a low crown upon his long skull. His arms and legs were heavy and bowed, with joints obscured by thick muscle and loose skin. Main was struck by the fancy that the Kappan's color, a blend of brown and olive, was that of a small dragon who had achieved a good suntan. A yellow kilt was his main article of attire, although he wore a few decorations of polished bone. One of the Terrans stepped forward. He wore a semi-military uniform. "I suppose you're Lewis Main," he asked. "Right," answered Main. "You would be Captain Voorhees of the Gemsbok." "Check. This here is Iamak. he's more or less chief of the village or tribe or whatever you want to call it. Mayne found his gaze sinking into cat-like slits of jet in a pair of huge orange eyes shaded by massive brow ridges. The native made some statement in a clicking language that had a harsh, choppy rhythm. "He welcomes you to Kappa," Haruhiku interpreted. "He hopes the gods will not be displeased." "What a warm welcome," commented Mayne. "Have you been getting along that well, Captain Voorhees?"
"Just about," said the spacer. "One of my boys knows a few words. Rest of time we make signs. I got to admit they ain't been too unfriendly."
"But they've seized your ship."
"You're damn right. That insurance guy they sent out don't see it that way, though."
"Where is this representative of the Belt Insurance Company?" asked Mayne.
"Merlin, his ship landed over on the other side of the village, about half a mile. Gotta be along soon. Must have seen you land."
Mayne wondered whether it were necessary to await the arrival of the insurance adjuster before asking any questions. To cover his hesitation, he turned to take his first good look at the hull of the Gemsbok. "What do you think they're doing?" he demanded, staring. The Gemsbok was, or had been, an ungraceful, thick spaceship on the verge of aging into scrap. Towering here between the village and the huge bluish-green leaves of the Kappan forest, she was in the process of being transformed into a planet-bound object of a certain weird grace. A framework had been constructed about the hull by a swarm of natives. They had reached halfway up the ship, which served as a central column. Much of the exterior appeared to be a network of strangely curved sections of wood that had been given a high polish. Mayne suspected the greenish highlights were reflections of the forest color.
"Bone," said Voorhees succinctly. "They collect it from things they catch in the sea. Main supports of timber, of course. Built to fit the hull."
"The fish here grow very large," put in Haruhiku. "If you could call them fish, that is. I once saw them butchering what looked more like a dinosaur." Mayne realized that the bone framework formed a sort of curtain wall. At the lower levels, some of the natives seemed to be experimenting with a coating of wet leaves which they were molding to the wall. "They soak them in something they boil out of fish parts," his pilot explained. "Like the village roofs. When it dries, it's pretty hard, even waterproof. The stink never dries out."
"But what do they have in their bony little brains?" asked Mayne. "Just what is that mess supposed to be?"
"A temple, believe it or not," answered Voorhees. "They tell me I set her down on a land sacred to the great god Mig."
Mayne looked at Haruhiku.
"Oh, come on now. I came all the way from—"
He stopped as he noticed the pilot's grave expression.
"Oh, that sort of thing could be serious, I guess."
He imagined he had seen the chief Iamak come alert at the mention of the local god. Mayne sighed. It was going to be a long day. He was saved for the time being by a hail from the direction of the village. A procession was approaching along the set of ruts between Mayne and the ship. The place of honor appeared to be occupied by a two-wheeled cart of crude but massive design. Upon it rode a Kappan driver, two Kappans with spears and the look of official guards, and a Terran with a death grip upon the side railing. A brace of truculent beasts of frighteningly saurine mane shuffled ponderously along in the loose harness. From time to time, one or the other would stumble over a turn in his rut and emit a menacing rumble as if he suspected his teammate of causing the misstep. Before and behind this conveyance marched a guard of honor of Kappan warriors. The rear contingent kept close to the cart, but the advance party had opened a noticeable gap between themselves and the hulking team. The procession halted. The soldier in charge raised his spear in salute to Iamak, and the shaken Terran was assisted to dismount. He introduced himself to Mayne as Robert Merlin.
"Let's go over to the hut they made for us and sit down," suggested Voorhees. Merlin, a tall, gloomy blonde whose civilian suit seemed a trifle formal for the surroundings, acceded gratefully. He mopped the dust from his long face and watched the cart being turned around. The procession moved off in the direction of the village, the advance guard stepping out especially smartly, and Maine began to get his conference arranged. He learned that the evicted crew of the Gemsbok had been living in the hut nearby. Before it stood a long table with benches, all evidently knocked together from recently felled timber. Merlin was given credit for this by Voorhees, since before the arrival of the insurance adjuster and his crew, no power tools had been available to the men from the Gemsbok. Maine took a place at the end of the table. Some of the Gemsbok crew came out from the hut to watch. Most of the Kampen warriors attending the chief took up stations between the table and the ship in a manner suggesting long habit. Maine guessed that attempts had been made to re-enter the ship. He put Haruhiku at his right hand to translate, should it be necessary. Merlin and Voorhees sat at his left, their backs to the hut. To the other side of the table, Iamak brought two Kappans, who were explained to Maine as being the tribal high priests Igrilik and Kanox, who represented a sort of district overlord. "I meant to land by their city," Voorhees put in, "but we hit some bad winds up in the stratosphere. Got knocked down a bit in the storm and set down where we could." "Well, tell me about the details," said Maine. "I want to get this straight from the start if I can." "By the way, Lieutenant Haruhiku explained to the chief that a special envoy is on the way, that we want his friendship, and that he will be dealt with fairly." He waited out the exchange of choppy speech between the pilot and Iamak. "He says he is sure he will be fairly dealt with," reported Haruhiku. "I wonder what he meant by that," murmured Maine. "If we make a deal here, and thereby with his overlord, will that cover enough territory to be official?" "As much as you can get together anywhere on this world, sir." Maine nodded, then turned to Captain Voorhees. "Now, about this so-called crash," she prompted. "Well, there was the storm, like I said. Trouble was we didn't expect to hit it, and, well, somebody took it in his head to blow some of the fuel tanks for a crash landing. That's why I'm not claiming anything on the fuel," he finished, turning to Merlin. "We are perfectly willing to pay on that item," replied the insurance man. "Anyhow," continued Voorhees, "I sit down here where we saw the open spot, and then, of course, we were stuck with nothing to lift off with. It looked all right. We unload some goods. If the local crowd couldn't use them all, why, they'd pass the rest on at a profit to themselves. So we come out to palaver, and then they won't let us back in the ship. We were just lucky my comm man had sent out a landing report when it looked like we piled up, or the Space Force Patrol would have never heard of us." "Was there any trouble?" asked Maine. "Any unnecessary hostility?" Voorhees considered, rubbing the back of his head thoughtfully. "Well, I suppose, looking at it their way, they could have been a lot rougher. A couple of punches got thrown, and one of my boys got a spear busted over his head. But mostly they acted, well, maybe more like cops than cannibals. Just enforcing the native laws, eh?" Voorhees did not swallow that quite so gracefully. He did not know or care what the local laws might be, but he thought it suspicious in the extreme that he should have plopped down exactly upon the spot chosen by the natives for a temple. "So do they have to use my ship to hang it on?" he finished plaintively. "The company is in agreement with you there, Captain," Merlin put in. "You see, Judge, our point is that nothing is really lost or seriously damaged, neither ship nor cargo. They are merely being withheld from their rightful owner, and we believe that puts the responsibility for recovery upon the Terran government. Captain Voorhees has our entire sympathy." "Yeah," said Voorhees. "And if I get my head sliced off trying to get that undamaged cargo, you'll come to my funeral. I say it's a loss." "Now, gentlemen," interrupted Maine, "let me get on with this. Both of you, I'm sure, realize that I'm not a lawyer, in spite of my being a special judge. If the colonies way out here had enough lawyers to spare, I certainly wouldn't be sticking my head into this. Nevertheless, any decision I make here will be regarded as legally binding by the government of Rigel IX.
so let us remain level-headed.
Very well, Judge, said Merlin. Here are the figures on...
Please round them off, said Maine. If I have to listen to a long list in centicredits, I'll probably go off and see what kind of beer they brew here.
You wouldn't like it, muttered Voorhees, staring sourly at the village.
No doubt, grinned Maine. Merlin swallowed and returned to an inner pocket a sheaf of papers he had withdrawn.
Speaking very loosely, he went on, as if hating to do anything loosely, the coverage was about as follows. For the Gemsbok herself, 2 million. But that was really a nominal figure accorded as a sort of courtesy. Otherwise, at her true worth, the authorities would hardly have permitted Captain Voorhees to take her into space.
Get on with it, urged Maine, to forestall any wrangle.
Yes. Then on the cargo, the purchase cost of 200,000 credits.
Voorhees visibly flinched and began to acquire a ruddy hue.
And finally, on the fuel load, the cost price of 300,000. Of course, Judge, there are detailed clauses as to the normal use of fuel. He was actually insured against defects, premature explosions, accidental loss, etc.
Maine did some addition in his head.
So your company, he said aloud, is prepared to pay $2.5 million for the loss sustained by Captain Voorhees. What seems to be wrong with that?
Both men began to talk, but Merlin, struggling less with temper, got the lead.
Actually, he says, we feel liable for only 300,000.
Now it will get tough, thought Maine. He silently awaited elucidation.
The combined stares of all parties, including the enigmatic glance of Iamak, calmed the sputtering Voorhees. Merlin continued,
in the first place, the true value of the ship, even if we consider her to be incapacitated, which we do not, is only about 150,000.
She's worth more than that as scrap, bellowed Voorhees.
No, Captain, just about that. It is exactly how we valued her. Do you have any idea, Judge, of how old that crock is?
Let's not get into that just yet, suggested Maine.
As to the fuel, said Merlin, I am willing as a gesture of goodwill to stick my company's neck out and mine with it, you may be sure, and honor a full claim.
Even though he used about half the fuel getting here? Asked Maine.
We'll ignore that. We admit that he is out of fuel, and we want to...
You want to give me a moon and take a star, said Voorhees.
Just a minute. Maine held up his hand. That's the ship and the fuel. What about the cargo?
Why, as to that, Judge, we do not admit that it is lost. It is right over there, easily accessible. We consider it more the job of the Space Force to restore rightful possession than it is the responsibility of the company to reimburse Captain Voorhees for the inflated value he sets upon it.
I begin to see, murmured Maine. You can't stick each other, so you're out to slip me the bill.